So, a couple of weeks back, we had Lamb and Wolfare last week. So, a couple of weeks back, we got into Luke 15. Luke 15 has a series of three parables, the lost and found parables. So, last week we looked at the parable of the sheep, the lost sheep. This morning we're looking at the lost coin. This one's a pretty short one, but let's face it, I can make it long. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin that I had lost." Just so I tell you, there's joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. There's going to be some similarity, obviously, between this parable and the last parable. A couple of things that to hold on to, and then a couple of thoughts, and then we're going to walk through some of these things. The first one is the word that I want you to kind of, I don't know, latch on to for a minute here is rejoice. This is going to come back up later in the message, but I want you to hold on to this picture of rejoicing over a lost coin in this particular case, the previous one, rejoicing over the lost sheep, and then in the parable for next week, rejoicing over the lost son. Remember here in Luke, though, if we back up a few parables, we have the parable of the great banquet, where we have a group of people who have all these excuses not to rejoice with the master of the house. And here there's this call, three times a call to rejoice. And you might stop and ask, why would somebody rejoice over finding a coin? Why would somebody rejoice over finding even a one sheep, right? Like, that seems kind of frivolous, and we're going to even talk about some of the frivolity of this. But I think in order to really grab a hold of how important the word rejoice is, you actually need to back up and understand the disparity of the word loss or lost as it is in all three of these parables. The word that's used for loss or lost or lose is rooted in apolemy. Now, if you know that word at all, or maybe you sort of know that word, apollyon, it means to destroy or be destroyed. So when we're talking about something lost, there is a great deal of despair and discouragement in this word. There's a difference, right? I think there's a difference between lost and misplaced. We're not talking about something misplaced. We're talking about something that, as far as they're concerned, it's been destroyed, right? We don't really get that until we get to the next parable. Maybe we don't grab a hold of that until the next parable, because there's that moment where the father says, "Your brother was dead, but is now alive." Like, the idea that he was dead, it's not just dead to me, he was destroyed, he was gone, he wasn't coming back. You know, you're thinking of a sheep. Well, a sheep can be replaced. A coin, at the end of the day, could be replaced. A son, no. No, it's like a degree of severity, and maybe we don't grab it until next week, but I didn't want to leave it to next week to talk about it, because I do want to talk this morning, at least around it, is this rejoicing that takes place. Why is this worthy of rejoicing? Now, when it comes to losing something, and like I already said, there is a difference between losing something and perhaps misplacing something, right? You don't necessarily know it at the time. As far as you're concerned, it's gone, it has disappeared, it is off the face of the planet. I think everybody here has probably lost something that we would deem important at some point in time or another, and we're convinced we're not going to find it. I've shared this story before. In fact, the first time I shared this story actually was when we did our very first Lamb and Wolfare message thing. When I first got here, we didn't have that. It wasn't until about 3 years in that we were invited to have the service down at Lamb and Wolfare. And so the very first time we did that, I shared this story. But it happened shortly before it. We had just moved into the house that we are in now. We were in a much smaller house over this direction, and now we're over there. But I had lost my keys, and a lot of people probably have lost their keys. Now, for me, it was a big deal. In fact, it kind of turned my whole, that whole week, it kind of went into this weird spiral. And it's odd for me to have lost my keys because I always have my keys with me. I always get on my kids when they don't know where their keys are. But for me also, it wasn't something small to lose. Back in that day, I used to carry a lot of keys because if you were familiar with the church back then, and again, we're talking 11 years ago, every single lock in this church had a different key. So there was a key for that door, there was a key for that door, there was a key for the door out in the in the fellowship hall. There was a key for my office, there was a key for, at the time, Betty's office. There was a key for, no key was used twice in this building. We have now reduced it down to we have the key card, and really, I have one key. I have the one ring for a key. It rules them all. It opens everything. I've reduced greatly. But at the time, I mean, it was a big, massive amount of keys, but it really wasn't even, I had my car key, I had my house key, had my, at the time, post office key, right? Everything. My life was unlocked via that bunch of keys. And so to have them missing was a great inconvenience in so many levels, but it really wasn't the keys that were the important factor to me at the time. What was really killing me was what was holding my keys. I had a metal carabiner, one that you use for rock climbing, and that was given to me by Doug West, and I had had it ever since. In fact, I had it since the summer of 1993, in fact, Doug had his keys, and again, at Tadmore, lots of keys, and so he had his keys on the carabiner like it, and I always made comments about the carabiner, and so the last summer that I got to work with Doug, on the last day, he gave me a carabiner, and so I've held on to that. So that was very important. So for it to be lost, for it to be gone, was it was horrific, honestly, because it couldn't be replaced. The keys could be replaced, the carabiner not the same way. We turned the house upside down. Well, it ended up being in a laundry basket, is how we ended up finding it. Probably my keys were probably on the coffee table, is the guess, and they fell into the laundry basket, probably one of the cats. And I don't want to throw anybody under the bus. It was one of my kids' laundry baskets, so I don't want to throw him under the bus. But it ended up, we finding it in his room in the basket, which also tells you that he probably didn't put away his laundry for at least a week, and because you would have obviously found them. But nonetheless, the keys were recovered, right? The idea, though, I mean, when I say I turned everything upside down, I mean, I flipped over couches, right? I mean, I was doing anything and everything to try to find these keys, and it was driving me nuts. We have the same sort of picture here in this parable, right? But it's a coin, okay? So what's the big deal here? So, first off, what are we talking about, a coin? Okay, so most likely this was a drachma, which was a day's wage, right? So you've got, she has 10 of these coins, one of them, one whole day's wage, it's missing. That's important, okay? There's a value to this coin. It's not, she didn't lose a quarter, okay? She didn't lose a 50-cent piece, right? If you know what a 50-cent piece is. She lost a day's wages. Well, there's some things that we need to understand to kind of maybe help us relate to it, right? Most likely we're talking about a single woman here. The only reason I say that is because she calls people to come rejoice. So people kind of go, well, she didn't call her husband, she didn't call her family. We have the single woman, right? And so she has 10 coins. This is it. This is her savings. This is what she has, right? And for what it's worth, no different than today, a woman didn't make the same amount as a guy. In fact, back then, most likely, most women made less than half of what a man made on the same jobs that they were allowed to do in that culture. So it's really not one day's wage, is it? It might be 2 or 3 days' wages that she's actually has lost. We don't really have any other details, right? We don't know, is she old, is she young, is she a widow? We don't know those things. All we know, she's missing a very valuable coin, and it's worth looking for. It has value. We have to remember who is the parable being addressed to, because again, the first of these three parables? Well, it's addressed to men because it's in the context of a shepherd. Yes, it applies to everybody, but only men would be shepherds. Okay, you didn't have women out in the field during those times. So, it's just what it is. So it's addressing men. Shepherd is dual, right? Because we're also dealing with religious leaders who are supposed to be shepherding the people, right? So we have these, that's the context of it. That's who it's getting pointed to, right? So in the case of the lost sheep, there's that dual purpose of that shepherding, which, by the way, I didn't bring this up last week, but when we start talking about the lost sheep, there is a different question that could be asked. Okay, we look at it and we think about it, and that's how I preached it. The sheep, sheep wander. We know this. They look for grass somewhere else. They do all sorts of things. So there's lots of reasons why a sheep could get lost. But the other question we could be asking, and I do believe Jesus is asking, as far as the religious leaders go, the Pharisees in particular, is the awareness of having a lost sheep, right? How did the sheep get lost? How is it that you got to a point? Obviously, at some point in the parable, that shepherd picked up on one missing. They, on the other hand, probably wouldn't have mattered. I still got 99, right? Why do I need that? I often equate that to a moment I had early on when Wendy and I got married. In fact, it was like literally right after our honeymoon, because we were returning a few duplicate items, from the wedding gifts and stuff. While we were there, I was handed some change and a penny fell on the floor. I didn't think much of it, right? Because it's a penny, right? But I had an older woman behind me tap me on the shoulder, and she says, "You dropped a penny." And I go, "Oh, yeah. And she goes, "Pennies make dollars, And of course, I'm thinking, no, pennies make heavy pockets. But, you don't think much of it. I still got 99, right? But then again, how many times have you been in the checkout and you go to use the change you have and you're literally one penny? Every time I'm a penny short of being able to pay with the change I have, I think back to that one penny I did not pick up. Actually, I did pick it up because I felt guilty when she said that. So, there's this picture, though, that, this coin, I mean, one out of 99, okay, how about one out of 10? All right, we've kind of made it a little bit more important, perhaps, right? The sheep, it has value. The shepherd, a true shepherd, would appreciate the value. So therefore, it's understandable why a true shepherd would rejoice over finding one. By the way, rejoice meaning what? To have joy again. Because what we see is the religious leaders that are being rebuked by Jesus in this particular moment, they are grumbling. Grumbling is the absence of joy. There is no rejoice because there wasn't any joy to begin with. Now, this particular parable, it seems to be pointed maybe towards the women of the audience. Again, it applies to everybody, right? But it's kind of this picture because the religious leaders wouldn't be women. So he brings up women. So maybe in this particular moment, you could kind of imagine, again, cultural context mattering, they might have checked out for a second. Well, at least until money was brought up, because money seems to perk the religious leaders' ears often. In fact, what's also interesting here is that it demonstrates the struggle anybody would have to have missing money, right? We all have had moments, I'm sure, where you're like, I could really use that right now, but I don't have that right now. And here, perhaps just like a lost sheep, the woman in her struggle would have been lost in the shuffle of things. Now, back to money for a second here. Jesus brings up money a lot. Now, I want to squash a statement that gets made often, that Jesus talks more about money than, and then you can fill in the blank. We need to stop that. Jesus talks more about loving your neighbor than anything else, not money. But money is a topic. Money gets brought up, but he doesn't bring it up. It's not about a negative thing or a positive thing when Jesus brings up money. In fact, what we find is that he usually uses it as an object lesson. And that's the key. Because everybody, I'm pretty sure of this one, everybody understands how money works, usually, right? And so it's interesting because when we look at the parables, over 40, you know, just over 40 parables, a quarter, just over a quarter of the parables use money as a tool or the object of the lesson, right? So you have the wise builder, and of course, you know, you got to understand when you're going to build, how you build, and the finances that are involved. There's the two debtors. You have one guy who owes a great deal of money. He's forgiven, but then he won't forgive a different guy who owes him a little bit of money, right? You have the rich fool. You have the pearl that has great value. You have hidden treasures. You have the counting the cost parable, where you wouldn't spend money you don't have, so you have to understand what your money can do today. You have the unjust steward who doesn't pay correctly. You have Lazarus and the what? The rich man, you know, and there's a picture of this guy who has his reward in full and lives very lavishly while Lazarus doesn't. You have the vineyard workers, which kind of makes a little bit of a twist on the unjust steward parable, because in the vineyard, you have the guy who gets hired at the very first part of the day, but then, you know, other people get hired, and then the last guy gets hired in the last hour of work, and yet they all get paid the exact same amount. And it's like, how fair is that? And of course, everybody here would think that's not fair. But why do we think the kingdom of God needs to be fair based on what we think? Everybody comes in the same. There's the parable of the talents, which you have three different guys given three different amounts of money, right? Resources from the master. The first two guys, they double it. The third guy, he sits on it. He literally buries it. The first two use the resources that are given by the master. Now, there is no indication that they had to double it. It's just what the parable tells us. I kind of come to this conclusion that those guys could have used it, invested it, and could completely have failed, and it wouldn't have been held against them because they trusted in using what the master gave. The rebuke comes to the guy who didn't take any risk whatsoever. I'll kind of hold on to that, circle back around to that notion later. And then, of course, here we have these three parables. We have the value of a sheep, because at the end of the day, the sheep are not pets. They will be sold, and one missing would, at the end of the day, be less money, right? Less of a job. And often shepherds back in those days did not own the sheep. A master owned the sheep, so you lost somebody else's property in that case. Here, it's a personal thing. It's a coin. Obviously, coin is money. Coin has value. And then when we get to the next parable next week, we have the sons, and look at how both sons treat money, how they treat the resources that they have. How about actual events that take place with Jesus in the Gospels? Again, we have the rich young ruler who comes and he walks away sad because he won't walk away from his money and the security he finds in money. You have the publican and the sinner. So you have the guy who's flexing his wealth while the other guy is beating his chest. What a sinner am I? You even have a humorous story concerning money where there is a temple tax that is due. And the religious leaders go to Peter and they start talking to the disciples. Doesn't your master pay taxes? Instead of actually going to Jesus, because at this point in time, this happens in Matthew 17. At this point in time, they've stopped talking to Jesus because they keep getting put in their place. So instead, they start trying to murmur things into the disciples, hoping it'll disrupt Jesus. I don't know if you've ever had somebody talk about you, to somebody close to you, hoping that you hear. That's what's happening there. And of course, what happens? Okay, so the tax was two coins, two drachmas, right? And so that was what was due. And what does Jesus do? He turns to Peter and says, "Hey, Peter, why don't you go fishing?" Which you got to think for a minute there for Peter. That's cool. I'm out of this awkward situation. I will go fishing every day if you ask me. So Peter goes and fish. And in the first fish he catches, what happens? He pulls it out, and what's inside the fish? Not two coins, but four coins. And that's what Jesus ends up paying double taxes, right? Because at the end of the day, when it comes to money, it doesn't matter. That's the bigger picture here. If God needs to supply, God will supply. Never mind the fact we have another picture of Jesus going out, if you will, the extra mile. You want two coins, I'll give you four. You want my tunic, I'll give you everything. And this is what happens. Speaking of the temple tax, we might even consider how the religious leaders might be thinking in this moment. Do they even care if somebody else lost money? And so what? Pay your taxes. I don't care if you don't have the resources. Pay your, does that sound familiar also? The government doesn't care if you lost your job. If you still owe, you still owe, right? And so here, maybe they don't even care that somebody lost a coin. What, this parable doesn't have anything to do with me. You know, does one coin have any value? You've heard the phrase, you ever had a backhanded compliment, right? It's kind of like a backhanded parable if you stop and think about it, because Jesus is actually rebuking them in this parable by saying, you don't even understand actual value the way this woman would understand value. You don't suffer the way she suffers in this case. How about even the moment where we have the widow who gives just two small coin, pences, right? Two small coins, because that's all she had. But she's mocked by the religious leaders because she hasn't given more money. But she has given more money, according to Jesus, because she gave everything that she had. There's always that measure of one person's trash is another person's treasure. Value is not an absolute, is it? Right? There are different things that people value differently. The cultural context, of course, here would be, you got to consider, she's searching for it and how she's searching for it. Because a house back then, houses weren't exactly elaborate, right? Now, the house that we're in now, it started out like this, and then they built and they built and they built. And if you've ever been in our house, you can get lost because it doesn't make sense. The layout doesn't make sense. There's angles in that house that they're not in geometry, and so it's easy to get something lost, is what I'm saying, because nothing makes sense. Here, your house would be literally a big rectangle with maybe a room or two that are also rectangles. Very simple houses made out of stone with some mud and some dirt, and it wouldn't be very elaborate. You probably didn't have a whole lot of windows, because windows meant exposure. You didn't have glass. So if you had windows and you didn't have shutters, you're just exposed. You're exposed to the elements. You're exposed to thieves. So it's better not to have windows. So when she talks about, when it talks here about using a lamp, right, there wouldn't be that natural light helping out the situation. So whether she's been searching all day and into the night, we don't know. We just know that she's taking every measure because it's not exactly an easy task at hand. But the point isn't the value of the coin even. Right, it's really the parables about the fervency, the deliberateness of finding the coin, much as the shepherd leaving 99 to go find one, a very deliberate action. But there is a cost. There's a cost to finding this coin and lighting up the room. Oil, you would have to pay for the oil to do that. And by lighting up the lamp, it definitely says that she took extra steps to try to find this coin. She didn't just kind of look, I just don't know where it is, and just kind of let it go, right? She's taking every effort to light up the room. The floor itself would be, hardened dirt and maybe a few rugs or something over the top of that. A lot of places for a coin to find its place, right? In fact, it's interesting, if you ever have watched any archaeology shows, that's usually the sign of a lost city. It's not, they don't find homes, they find money. And then they kind of trace where the money is, and they can start tracing actually out the outline of homes because of where the coins might be found. Coins aren't found in the wilderness, they're found in places where people lived, and they start measuring that out. This would have been one of those coins, and archaeologists would have found, 300, 400, 500 years later kind of a situation. How many of you have found a coin stuck in between your car seat or your seat cushion? You're not even looking for it, and all of a sudden you're like, wait, what? There's a quarter. I was a kid of, I grew up, born in the 70s, grew up in the 80s. I'm a Gen Xer. Okay, and Gen Xers, one of the things that distinguish us is, we didn't necessarily have a summer. For a Gen Xer, was no parents because mom and dad were at work, right? And so you're at home, and when you hear the ice cream truck come, because back then it was a different time, right? I mean, kids could chase after a stranger in a strange little vehicle driving through the town, and it was totally acceptable. But you start turning over couch cushions, anything you can to try to find some spare change to buy that fudgesicle or that bomb pop or whatever, right? I mean, the couch literally was the savings account for many kids. Or maybe it's more akin to the lottery, I suppose, because you just never know what you might find. You definitely found it and you spent it before you let anybody know it was there. That's the moral of the story. Now, maybe it's been that moment. Think about the feeling you might get. You know, you put on a pair of pants and you reach into the pocket and you find out you washed some money, but you know, it's there and you didn't know it was there. And like, hey, I've got a couple extra dollars in my pocket that I didn't. It kind of gives you a little bit of a good feeling. Maybe you start to understand a little bit of that rejoicing. Now imagine if you reached in your pocket and found a few hundred dollars. That might change everything, right? I mean, that's a lot of bomb pops right there. So, but it's something you thought was gone. Maybe you didn't even know it existed for what it's worth. But now you have it. There is a measure of rejoicing in that, right? Of course, see, here the difference here is that it is something, though, that she knew she lost. It wasn't just something that was found. She knew it was missing. She was aware that it was missing. Again, going back to that moment with the shepherd and considering the religious leaders, do they even know what's missing? The other thing maybe to note is the response, that rejoicing, and how that rejoicing looks. And stop and consider all the expense she goes to find the coin using a lamp. Oil wasn't cheap. And then on top of that, she apparently throws a party afterwards, right? There's a lot of expense over this one particular little coin, right? A Swiss scholar, Schweitzer, retells when he's talking about this particular parable, he retells this story early on in his time in ministry. He was teaching this parable to little kids in a Sunday school class. And one of the kids commented, "What a dumb woman." And he goes, what do you mean, what a dumb woman? And the kid said, well, she spends more on a party than probably the coin was worth. Like, we don't necessarily know that, right? But that was the kid's impression of this moment. He thought, how ridiculous is this? But yet, this took Schweitzer by surprise because it was something he hadn't actually considered in its fullness. The actual picture within the picture of this parable, the picture of God's grace and what God's grace does. That maybe this parable isn't about money at all. It's not a parable about economics. It's a picture of grace. To which then I stop and I think of James Edwards, not Jonathan, but James Edwards, who loves to talk about the folly of God's grace. Now, it's a kind of a weird little thing to kind of try to put your finger on, because I don't want to make God sound like he's frivolous, like he doesn't know what he's doing. But yet, if we stop and we think about it, well, often when we talk about folly, we're talking about our own folly, right? A fool's folly. But we don't necessarily talk about what God's folly might look like. I mean, stop and think about for a moment here, and I'm sure you have at some point in time or another. But how ridiculous is the gospel? I mean, the gospel is just absolute absurdity. Honestly. Where does the gospel begin? That God so loved the world that he sent his son? Why? Why should he send anything? Never mind the fact that he pays our debt. Now, often what gets said is that he pays. I've heard it preached before, and I understand what they're saying, but it's wrong. That how ridiculous is it that God pays the debt that's owed to him? But that's not what the gospel is about, is it? Who actually is owed it? Well, according, if I'm reading Romans right, the wages of sin is death. It's not God that we're paying this debt to. It's sin and death that we pay it to. That's an extension of our separation. And yet, this debt, all of it, would be at his expense, which we'll see in the parable next week also. It comes down to the psalmist who says, who am I that you would pay me mind? Like, how ridiculous is it that God did all of these things? And even more, how ridiculous is it that we think we have anything to contribute to it, to take away from what God has done for us? The expense of this search, the rejoicing over the found, and again, the picture of something being lost is destroyed. And if it's destroyed, that means it's lost forever. I can't help but think This last week, I was watching the news, and in Wisconsin, they had the tornadoes that came through. And if you've seen any pictures of tornadoes, but if you saw the pictures this last week, entire neighborhoods just decimated. Sometimes you usually have those weird ones, right, where it's like a couple houses are destroyed, but then everything else seems to be fine. This wasn't the case. These things were huge where they came through, and they ripped through this whole entire stretch, and it was just, everything was just scattered everywhere, and nothing was discernible. You couldn't tell what was what. And they're interviewing this teenage girl, and they just asked her. He says, "You know, do you hope to rebuild?" And she goes, "I hope." Like what do you? First off, how ridiculous is it to ask that question? But just to be there and just saying, "But you don't understand. Everything that's gone isn't coming back." Yeah, we know you can replace things. But there's something missing now, right? It's lost. And for these parables, the picture of loss is much more than misplaced. It's the intention is something that you might consider not coming back. But again, we kind of lean more heavily into that in the parable of the lost son. But this picture of grace, the expense that God goes through, yes, it's a rebuke on the religious leaders, but it's not telling the religious leaders what you need to do. It's telling them what God is doing. If we go back to the sheep parable, right, there is a cost to leave the 99. The picture here would be that the 99, they don't need to be found, right? So if you're living right, you're living good, you don't need to be found. You already are found. The religious leaders, they're grumbling. Why are they grumbling? Because Jesus is spending time with somebody that's not them. Honestly, this the gist of the religious leaders throughout the New Testament is this petty and selfishness. If God is going to come to earth, maybe this is why they didn't believe Jesus was God. Because if God was going to come to earth, certainly he would be spending time with them, not somebody else. They're owed his attention. And yet Jesus' teaching is consistent. What? The healthy don't need doctors, right? And in fact, a couple weeks back here, I had to go into the ER because my back and stuff, and I didn't want to go because I don't want to clog up the system with people who actually have problems. Luckily, I got in there, and apparently, it's like rush hour traffic. I don't know. I got in just before because they just saw me and took care of me, and then by the time we were exiting, the waiting room was full. You know, but I even had a small conversation with the ER doctor. He's not too happy with the system at the moment. Surprise. Because there's a lot of people who clog up the system. Sure, you don't want to be one of those people. And yet that's kind of the picture the religious leaders are. We deserve the attention, not them. Right? No one dies for a righteous person. Hold on to that. We're going to come back to that in Romans. But you stop, and have you ever thought about that phrase, like no one would die for a righteous person, but maybe for another, you know, a good person? You stop and you consider why. Why would you die for somebody else other than the fact that you have value for their life? But if I was to die, if I'm good with God, and I'm saying I'm willing to give up my life so somebody else can live a little bit longer, what am I really saying? I want them to have as much time as possible to get right with God too. So the 99, in the case of that parable, they need to get out of the way so that the one could be found. Now the kicker there, you know, no one's righteous, right? At the end of the day, no one is. The Bible tells us this. There's no one who's actually healthy. If I was to ask you today, and you don't need to raise your hand, but are you okay? Pretty sure there's something in your life. You're like, I'm not okay. And the gospel addresses that. There's no one without the need of a Savior. We think we can do it on our own. I can do it. Just like some little kid who, you know, you hand a kid a steak and a knife, you know, they're convinced they can cut it. Are they going to cut it? No, they're going to cut themselves. I can do it. But the religious leaders, they keep putting up the front. They can't admit it, by the way, because if they admit it, then they would have to actually do what? They'd actually have to repent. They'd actually have to change. Instead, what do? They keep telling Jesus he's the one who needs to repent. There's some irony there. It's why we see the story of the shepherd concluding with what? He's carrying the sheep back. It's a picture of it's too weak to come back on its own. It has to rely on someone else. Here we have the picture of a woman looking for a single coin. She's got nine. I mean, 9 out of 10 is not bad. That's still an A if you're grading a paper. 90%? I'll take 90%. To some, primarily the religious as a whole, the whole thing would seem kind of frivolous. It would be folly to go searching so desperately for one coin. But to anyone in the audience who's ever had to make a day's wage stretch, a couple days, maybe even a month, it might be a different story now. Moreover, it's at what expense, what absurdity, what determinedness, right, that the gospel goes out into. I've been in ministry for too long. My first paying position, if you will, if that's where you want to mark it, 1996, but I've been in ministry since 91, and I've seen the same arguments. It doesn't matter what church you're in, same arguments come up over the expenses of things and the criticisms that usually, I mean, here we are, we're coming up on VBS. That's usually the big one. There's two areas that seem to get targeted the most. I'm going to hit both of them. But VBS, people talk, oh, VBS is so expensive. And it is, right? It's expensive. But not only is it expensive financially, but it's expensive in time. We're asking people to give time, not just money, but give time. We don't charge for VBS. I've never been in a church that charges for VBS. And yet every time we do VBS, somebody comes to register and they inevitably ask, what's the registration fee? And we say there's none. And they're like, yeah, but what? Yeah, no, there's none. Yeah, you can buy a shirt if you want, but that's just the cost of the shirt, you know? But we don't charge for VBS. Again, I've never been a part of a church that charges for VBS. I know some churches do, and that's whatever. But there are some people like, but is there really any real return in it? I mean, we're just spending money, aren't we? Well, I don't know. Kids are getting exposed to the gospel. We're loving on our neighbor. I think we're doing everything that the Bible is asking us to do. So what if it costs us a couple dollars? We don't, you know, here, we don't charge for anything that we do. I've specifically here, I've gotten a lot of criticism over that one. That we should charge. You know, if we're going to have a meal that we're inviting people to, like our breakfast, we don't charge people for our breakfast. Come eat. Maybe they'll stick around for church. I don't know. But bare minimum, we have them at the table for a minute, right? And the bare minimum, they had breakfast that morning. But there are some who think, oh, you should charge for everything. You know, you got to pay for it somehow. Yeah, it's part of our giving. The other big one, VBS being one, the other one, and this is something I'm watching the trend. In fact, I actually had a long conversation with some other pastors and whatnot, but churches are abandoning youth programs. Specifically, they're not hiring youth pastors anymore. Youth pastor is a dying thing now. And you know why? Because the one thing that probably eats up the majority of the resources in a church is the youth program, inevitably. And the one program that doesn't pay for itself is the youth program. Junior high and high school generally don't give to tithing and general funds and things like that. I've got some youth pastor friends. I never was into fundraising. You know, we've done the spaghetti dinner type thing, but I don't consider that necessarily fundraising. That's just a way for people to recognize how they can give and have some fun while doing it. But I don't sell chocolate bars, and I've got some guys who are still youth pastors. You know, I came through the youth ministry, but they're more marketing managers than they are youth pastors. They're always strapped to selling something, because if they don't, they don't have the resources to get kids to camp. And it's not like they just want money. They're trying to get things done. And so what are they doing? They're selling chocolate bars. And when they're not selling chocolate bars, they're selling fireworks. And when they're not selling fireworks, they're selling Christmas trees. And whatever the holiday is, you know, they're capitalizing on it. They're hoping, right? And all their energy gets spent on money management. Not because they want to, They begrudge every single second of it because that's the only way it's going to get done. Because churches, a lot of churches don't. The church I came from, I was the associate pastor. Do you know what associate pastor means? It's a glorified youth pastor title. Because the church actually had a youth pastor before me, they fired him because they didn't feel like there was enough return. So they were going to hire an associate pastor the next time around. What an associate pastor is, well, you do the youth and whatever else the senior pastor doesn't want to do, right? That used to be the title of a youth pastor. What does the youth pastor do? Everything a senior pastor doesn't want to do. Well, now we call that position associate pastor. Nothing new under the sun. But nonetheless, every year I had to defend my youth budget. And every year there was always somebody who was like, yeah, but how much money are the kids bringing in? They measured dollars per, I'm going to say this politely, rears in seats. Well, we're giving you this much money. How many kids are in youth group? Never once by those same people, and I have very specific people in mind, never once was I asked, well, how many of those kids made a commitment to Christ? Never once was I asked, how many baptisms did you have this year? Never once did I have, how many kids came to an event that had previously not come to an event? It was dollars per people, always. And the threat was always, if it doesn't meet our standard, you're going to lose funding. If it doesn't meet our standard, you might lose your job. It was every year that was the push. Because it was about the money, not about the, what does it cost to do whatever it is that you need to do. A lot of times it's not about money at all, is it? It's really not. It's not about expense, it's about time. But what does the world tell us? Time is money. Who's who in this parable, right? And maybe your interpretation might vary, because it's always one of those weird things because we kind of look at it and we go, so in this case, the picture of the woman, that's Jesus. And then you get weird about it, right? You're like, wait a minute, yes, Jesus is a woman. And that it's not literal, it's a metaphor. Also, she did lose the coin. How she lost, I don't know. Did Jesus lose any? No, Jesus doesn't lose anybody. So obviously you can't make a one for one. But we do have a picture here of what is happening, right? There's this, some people will approach this parable as the value of the coin. Perhaps we need to approach this parable as a picture of the unwavering gospel. This means that the coin in this, that's the figure that we're looking at. The coin is who? The coin is the lost sinner. The coin itself, I mean, as coins do, they don't have a consciousness. It's not alive, not like a sheep. But at the same respect, the sinner, most of the time, sinners don't know they're sinners. I mean, just in definition. Like, they know they are, but they won't put that name on. Sinners don't know they're lost. Most people don't know they're lost. I'm not a fan of that phrase, everybody runs around with a God-sized hole in their heart, because if that's the case, you really don't have a heart, because that's a big hole, right? I think we kind of get a little lost in that image, because we usually try to use it like, we try to fill it with everything else but God, and it's never full, but if you put, I get it. I do believe, though, that intertwined with who we are is our, let's call it our Imago Dei DNA, being made in His image. There's something about that we all know inherently. There's something more, but sometimes we don't know what the more is, not until it's revealed to us. The act of the woman, like the act of the shepherd, is a picture of God, Jesus, searching, and searching how? Searching at their expense. It's using their resources. And it stands to reason that this is the picture that Jesus is painting. It's the same yet different from the first parable. The difference being that, we have a picture of that sheep. That sheep wandered, right? So it got lost because it moved away. But the coin is just not here. The coin didn't lose itself. It just never was. It's just not there. We follow it up with the third parable of the son. And what's interesting in that parable, unlike the first two parables, there's no searching involved at all, is there? There's just waiting. We'll get to that next week. But all three end exactly the same. Celebration. Rejoicing. What was lost, what was considered gone forever, has been found. And when that happens, there is celebration. And not only is there celebration here on earth, but there is celebration in heaven. And when Jesus says that, when Jesus says that your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, this is included. If the angels are rejoicing, certainly we would rejoice. Or are we just trying to figure out if it fit our budget? Was it worth the money we put out? Overall, this is a picture of seeing the sinner, the lost, come to realize that they are indeed a sinner and lost. All have sinned and fall short of the glory, not some, right? It's to be shown and to be found the way home, and recognizing that you were away from it in the first place. The gospel itself is what? Good news. And of course, if you ever heard that phrase, the gospel is good news. Good news means and implies what? Bad news. It's understanding that, right? It's understanding what Romans tells us. Well, while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. Now, real quick here, can I pause and talk about the absurdity of God and really honestly just how dumb God seems to be? Because I don't know about you, but you see, we had this moment where we call the fall. You know, and he says, I'm going to make it right. Why didn't he just make it right then? Stands to reason. That would have been the ideal time. Fix it when it's broken. What does Romans tell us? At the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. There is a moment in the next parable where you kind of look at the father and you go, why didn't the father go after his son? We'll get into it next week. Because at the right time, God is a God of order. I don't understand the order sometimes. No, I don't understand the order anytime. Usually I don't understand the order until after it's been done. And I go, oh, now I see why it had to happen that way. But during the waiting, no. But at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. The ungodly, by the way, that word, lost. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, because you don't need to. No way he died for Jesus. That's kind of, you know, we could tell, oh, I could have, man, a whole nother sermon right here. About the whole point where Peter's like, I will die first. You don't need to die for Jesus. Quit. There are some people who are under this impression that you need to defend God to the point of death. He doesn't ask you to do that. Find me where he says to do that. No. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps, maybe, kinda, sorta. For a good person, one would dare, that word think, even to die. But God shows his love for us that while we were still sinners, that's all of us, me included, Christ died for us. Since therefore, see, so what do we have there? That God shows his love for us, that's good news. That while we were still sinners, that's bad news. Christ died for us, back to good news. Since therefore we have now been justified by his blood, which implies that you were what? Previously not justified. That's bad news, but we've been justified. That's good news. Much more shall we be saved by him from the wrath of God. See, there's this big bowl with our name on it. And he's saying, you're not going to be in its path. It's not going to hit you. You don't have to worry about that bowl. There are other people who are going to have to worry about it. Who? Those who aren't justified. But we will be saved by him from the wrath of God. For while we were enemies, bad news, we were reconciled to God by the death of his son, kind of good news. Much more means better news. Now that we are reconciled, shall we be saved by his life? How are you? Are you saved by his death? That we often say that. No, we're saved because there's an empty tomb. He could have died and then been dead. Paul tells us that. He says if he's still dead, he didn't resurrect, we're to be pitied. We are, in fact, the word is apolemy, we are lost. Still in our sin. But see, we are saved by what? His life. Not that he led a good life. Not the good person up there, not the righteous person up there, but his life post-resurrection. More than that, we also rejoice in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have now received reconciliation. Good news. You were enemies. It's been reconciled. This is the good news of the gospel. But what does verse 11 tell us, though? More than that, we also what? Rejoice. It's so important to understand. We get to rejoice. We are invited into a great banquet of rejoicing. We get to rejoice because the lost has been found. What was dead is alive. Something key in both passages that we've looked at, neither object at the end of the day knew it was lost. Now, we can make the argument with the younger son in the next parable. He came to the conclusion he was lost. At least he wasn't where he wanted to be. But the sheep don't know that it didn't know it was lost. Because if it knew it was lost, it'd probably come back. The coin doesn't know it's lost. For the sake of the teaching, for the rebuke, the reproach, the key is that there was somebody who did know. And they sought after that which was lost. We're talking about money. If we're going to talk about money biblically, we're inevitably going to talk about tax collectors. By the way, all the parables, you know, when I said a quarter of the parables that use money, all of those parables that deal with money or wealth, they're all found in only two gospels. They're found in Luke and they're found in Matthew. Now, Luke is recounting what stuck with the people who he interviewed. Matthew, what was Matthew's profession before he became a disciple? He was a tax collector. So you know what? Matthew's ears perked up when money, and he wrote it down because he understood what money does with people. So we're going to talk about tax collectors. Let's close with the greatest Sunday school lesson of all tax collectors. All right? And you can have the song going through your head for the rest of the day. He, that's Jesus, entered Jericho and was passing through, and behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector. He wasn't just a tax collector. He was the tax collector. And he was what? He was rich, because most tax collectors got their wealth that way. And he was seeking to see who Jesus was, but on account of the crowd, he could not, because he was little. Wee, if you will. Small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up the sycamore tree to see him, for he was about to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and he said to him, Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today. Can we just notice something here? And you do what you want to do with it, but let's just look at the truth of the matter. Who invites Jesus? Jesus invites Zacchaeus. Can I just tell you real quick here? Stop inviting Jesus into your heart. Rather, let him invite you into his. So he hurried and he came down and he received him joyfully. Now I got to be honest. Okay, so you got this guy, he's a tax collector, he's rich, he's wealthy. He could have had somebody hoist him up if he really wanted to. No, he climbs up the tree and it is a very, undignified thing. We're going to see that next week with the Father, by the way. So the thing is, it doesn't matter about your humility at the time when Jesus says, come. And when he saw it, who's they? Religious leaders. Maybe even some of the extra Jews who have had to pay Zacchaeus. They all grumbled, complained. They don't like this. He was gone to be the guest of a man who is a sinner, because that would imply they're not. And Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, behold, Lord, and by the way, this is all happening before he even gets to the meal. Behold, Lord, the half of my goods I give to the poor. Now, it was a profession, whether it was crooked or not, that doesn't matter. Whatever he has, he earned by law. And he says, I give up half of it. Okay, so I'm giving up all my profit is what he's saying, right? So I give it to the poor. And if I have defrauded anyone, that's a big if, right? If I have defrauded anyone, I restore it fourfold. Do you know where the fourfold is going to come from? It's going to come from the other half that he didn't give away. It's going to come out of his paycheck. It's out of his resources. Hold on to that thought also when we get to the parable of the sons. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house because, you know, he gave away money, right? No. What is happening here? He's repenting. He's turning away from what he was to something he is to call, he's called to be, which is what? He's also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost. While his repentance is important here, I think what's more important is verse 10. His repentance comes because Jesus came to seek and save the lost. He couldn't have been saved before that. He couldn't have been saved otherwise. So I've got a couple of questions to wrap up this morning. Where are you today? Are you lost or are you found? Right? Because if you're amongst the found, I only have one question. Why do we live like we're lost then? And what do I mean by that? You got worry, you got anxiety, you got doubting, you got all these things that are causing you to act like everybody else. But if you're found, you should have a sense of security. It's easier said than done, but I'm just trying to tell you, you should have a sense of security. And security doesn't usually have worried, anxiousness, and doubting involved. Maybe the question is, do you know, if you're lost, do you know, when do you know you're lost? How do we know we're lost? We don't know we're lost until we realize we're not where we're supposed to be. We're not lost, we don't know we're lost until somebody lets us in on it. There's a moment, I haven't brought any TV or movies in yet. So the TV show, The Walking Dead, right? It's a zombie show. Okay, whether you like that or not, that doesn't matter. But in the first season, they learn the big plot twist. They're all in, by the way, spoiler. We're all infected. We're all going to become the walking dead, right? That's the, when you die, you're going to be a zombie. That's the, you know, the premise of the show, because you have something in you. Everybody does. And so it's that picture of you're already dead and you don't even know it. It doesn't really matter. How about The Sixth Sense? Another spoiler. But again, I've talked about this one before. And again, if you still haven't seen The Sixth Sense, it's too late. All spoilers are off the table. It's 20 plus years old now, right? But you learn at the end of the movie, he's been dead the whole time. And if you don't know what that means, go watch the movie. But the whole point, though, is that you're following this character through the whole entire movie, and there's signs literally everywhere. But if you don't know to look for it, if you're not paying attention, you're just watching the movie trying to figure out, where is this going? Where is it going? He's been dead the whole time. He actually isn't interacting with everybody else. He's just interacting with one kid. But he doesn't know he's dead. But then suddenly he realizes he's dead, as the audience does as well. The point of the gospel really is about light, right? And what does light do? Light reveals what we don't know. Everything's scary in the dark. You're convinced somebody's standing in the corner until the light comes on and you just see it's a pile of laundry. Or it's a person and you just turn the light back off. Right? We even treat it like that. It's better not to know sometimes, right? Ignorance is bliss. But once you know, the Matrix. Once you know, you can't go back. Right? And that's the idea here. And I want you to notice something in all three, the shepherd, the woman, and even the father. At no point in time does anybody display any worry, anxiety, or doubt in these parables. Not a single one. The shepherd doesn't go, I don't know if I'll find my sheep. The woman doesn't go, I don't know if I'll find my coin. They don't stop until they do. That's assuredness, not anxiety. How do you know if you're lost? Well, how about this one? Do you know somebody who doesn't know they're lost? The answer is yes. So maybe the better question is, how are you going to show them they're found? Sometimes I think we, when we think about the gospel, Paul says, I become all things to all people so that I might win some. And maybe we kind of get this picture, and you know, there's a lot of fishing in the gospels, right? So you cast out a net. And maybe that's your gospel approach. I'm just going to cast out a net. Maybe I could use it a different approach. It's the shotgun approach, right? When you shoot a shotgun, what are you hoping? You're hoping a wide spray of something is going to make contact in the right place at the right time. And not to say that the gospel is all about fishing or hunting, right? That's a Father's Day message, I think, probably. But rather than a shotgun approach, maybe it's a little bit more of a sniper approach. That's horrible. But think about it. Maybe it needs to be a little bit more targeted. You don't go, I'm going to say this, and there will be some pushback from somebody, not necessarily anybody here, but you don't go hunting with an Uzi. You don't go hunting with automatic weapons, usually, right? Unless you're really bad aim, I guess. And if you've ever watched any movie, all you know is that the thing that you're shooting at with an automatic weapon has to do with this, and they never get hit. So, you know, obviously they don't work. Maybe we need to be a little bit more targeted. Maybe we need to be a little more intentional. She didn't go looking for coins. She knew one coin that was missing, so she went for the coin. The shepherd knew one sheep that was missing, so they went for the sheep. There was one son that was missing, and the father waited for him. Better yet, how about this? And this is the harder one. Is there anybody you're grumbling about? Did you ever stop to think maybe the thing that upsets you the most about them is the fact that they are lost? Maybe the remedy here isn't about grumbling about them, but it's, would you just set everything else aside and go after them? If I'm supposed to be like Jesus, now I can't save anybody. That's where the difference between Jesus and me exists, right? But if I'm supposed to be like him, am I supposed to do this? I think so. I think that's what Jesus is saying. He's not talking just to the religious leaders. Sometimes we think that. Oh, he's just hammering those religious. He's hammering every single person. He's teaching Peter, and he's teaching John, and he's teaching all the rest of the guys. He's teaching everybody who has ears to hear. He came to seek and save. And when he says to the disciples specifically, now go, he's saying, I want you to seek. Now, we can't do the saving part, but we can help them understand what that means. Let's pray. Father, we do thank you. We thank you for this morning. We thank you for the opportunity it is to gather together, Lord. And Father, we thank you for what it means to be a part of, part of a flock, part of a complete set of coins, perhaps. I don't know. But I'm pretty convinced, Lord, that there's a coin missing in the room. Pretty convinced there's a sheep missing in the pen. And Lord, I know you know exactly where they are. And Father, I think maybe you're calling us to go to them. Maybe. Absolutely. So Father, I just pray that, Lord, that you, I even as I pray this, I have people in my head. And I know there are others who have people in theirs. Lord, I believe that's where you've already sent us. We need to stop waiting to be sent. We've already been sent. Let's go. And Father, as we come to this table, let us remember the folly, the expense, the extravagance, the lavishness of the gospel. That you sent your son. He came to seek. He paid the cost. The debt's been paid that we might be free, unshackled, no longer lost, no longer dead, but found in your arms, found in your hands, that no one can snatch us from. And Father, if we have that confidence, let us demonstrate that to those who don't. We just pray this in your son's name. Amen.